Hello, and welcome to Story Radio, the podcast for readers, writers, and lovers of literature everywhere. Today, we're delighted to be speaking to Dr. Miles Leeson. He is the director of the Iris Murdoch Research Centre at the University of Chichester and visiting research fellow at Kingston University. He is lead editor of the Iris Murdoch Review, series editor of Iris Murdoch Today with Palgrave Macmillan, host of the Iris Murdoch podcast, and has published widely on Murdoch's work. He co-edited her selected poetry, Poems from an Attic, Selected Poems 1936 to 1995, published by Penguin in 2025, which we're discussing today, and is currently writing Visiting Mrs. Bailey and Other Essays, 2026, Iris Murdoch and Feminism, and editing the Oxford Handbook of Iris Murdoch, 2028. Welcome to Story Radio, Miles.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you for inviting me on.
The title of the collection is Poems from the Attic. Could you tell us about how you came across the collection and the work you had to do to create it?
Yes, of course. So 2016, we'd just opened the Iris Murdoch Research Centre at the University of Chichester, and myself and our visiting professor, Anne Rowe, who is one of the editors of the volume, she and I were invited to go to Iris Murdoch's former home in Oxford, in Charbury Road, by John Bailey's second wife. So after Iris had died, her husband John Bailey married again, and then John died in 2015, and then Anne and I were invited to go and see the house, primarily because at that point in time, Anne Rowe had just finished editing Iris Murdoch's Selected Letters with Avril Horner. And Audi Bailey, John's second wife, was a little bit surprised that we hadn't included her letters and from Iris. And Anne didn't know about them, but she said, please come along and meet me. It'd be lovely. So, to go to Iris's house was a lovely treat. And it was very similar to how Iris had left it when she was alive. So it was cleaner, but all the furniture, paintings, the book collection, everything was still in situ. So it felt very much as if you were still walking into Iris's house, which was wonderful. But after we'd had tea and cake and a tour of the house, Audi said, would you like to have a look in the attic? And so we did. And we went up this very rickety wooden stairs up into the attic. And nobody had probably been in there for at least 15 or 20 years, and had a look around. And there was all sorts of, the accumulated material of a life, or several lives, really. And there in the corner, alongside lots of books, was a big wooden chest, and Anne and I opened it, and inside were letters, photos, and various other things. But underneath all of that were 10 notebooks of poetry. And so it took obviously quite a long time we got them into the archives at the University of Kingston. Then it took a long time to process them, transcribe them, and think about them. But when it came to actually thinking of a title for the collection, we thought Poems from the Attic would probably be a very apt one for a selected poems of Iris Murdoch.
It's every scholar's dream, I imagine, to have something like that
happen. It is, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah, something brand new. As I say, a wonderful number of people worked on the collection. I've got the title was actually thought up by another co-editor, Francis White, and then our final editor, Rachel Herschler, was the main transcriber. I mean, there's about 550 poems in the notebooks, and then we whittled it down to 110, 112 that we sent to Chatto. Then ultimately, the collection that has just been published is 88 poems, the vast majority of which have never been published, so they're brand new to readers. And yeah, I think there's some fascinating ones in there that tell you a lot about her life, her loves, and also her, her fondness for nature, and indeed the poetic form as well.
The collection is grouped around the different phases of her poetry. Could you talk about the phases in her poetry in theme and style?
Yeah, sure. I think the first thing to say is that some of Murdoch's earliest poetry that she wrote when she was a teenager had been published in the 1930s. So, just after she'd written it, and it came out both in a little collection that she edited of her and her students at Badminton School and the sort of local schools in Bristol, with a foreword from W.H. Auden in the 1930s, so who she sort of convinced that he ought to write the introduction. Quite a thing, I think, for a young teenage girl to ask Auden, right? And then she'd published a few when she was at Oxford and so on. But we wanted really to show the great range that she wrote. So She deals with, she say, various different themes. So in her early juvenilia, she's dealing with particular poetic forms that she really likes, the sonnet form, particular different genres, I suppose. So she's interested in the kind of the Edward Lear kind of fantastical kind of poem. She's interested in nature writing. She's interested in also very emotionally charged poetry around her own life. So there's a lot of material in this collection, sort of thematically structured around her own kind of private emotional life. And those poems were perhaps the most difficult to edit and think about publishing. But yeah, you can see the development of her own style as she works her into a more mature phase. She's getting out from underneath the kind of the influences of people like Auden and Louis MacNeice, but also earlier writers like particularly, I think, Browning and Tennyson, the great Victorian poets. One of her students who she works alongside with at Oxford said that Marjorie Boulton said she gave a great talk in 1942 on Eliot and Auden and MacNeice, and she really had a really strong grip of the British, particularly the British poetic canon, and she knew exactly what she wanted to say in that lecture to her fellow students. And clearly, I think there's a great influence of those particular writers on her own style.
With her fondness for these earlier forms, how does she fit into the world of poetry these days, do you think?
I think it's interesting, isn't it, looking back and thinking that, obviously, although it's been published now, she sort of finishes writing poetry really in the kind of late 80s, early 90s. So we're looking back at least, 35 years, really, to think about Murdoch. And that's her mature phase. And then we're looking right the way back almost 100 years to the beginning of her, 90 years or so back to the beginning of her poetic work. So how she fits in now, I think it's more, I think in terms of the modern poetry and free verse, I think she's doing something very different. I think she's, in terms of, it's easier, I think, probably to see her in terms of how she relates to her own time. So thinking of maybe Elizabeth Jennings or Larkin or later Ted Hughes, I think she's doing something very different to the poets of her own time. And Adine, of course, very different to the poetry that's being written at the moment, I think. And yet she is, I think, working in particular classical modes of poetic writing, the way that she uses rhyme and rhythm schemes, even the forms of take, for example, the form of the sonnet. She does something new and interesting with that. And I can talk a little bit about that if you like, but certainly it's not a kind of the classic historical sonnet that we'd understand from Shakespeare or indeed earlier. It's a very different way she uses the rhyme scheme. It's a very different kind of way of writing the sonnet, I think. And yeah, she's also got a deep fondness, I think, for the metaphysicals. Much earlier poetry. So she's really well-versed and well-read. And then she's trying to tackle particular forms within her poetry, but always, I think, coming back to her own particular obsessions, particularly nature and the erotic. I think those are the sort of two counterweights within the collection that we've just published.
Yeah, does she kind of use the volta in the sonnet, which is kind of quite an important thing, do you think?
Yes, she does. She does, absolutely, yes. Right. Toward the end of the sonnets, yes, she absolutely does. Yeah, that's a really important aspect of the one. So I find that honesty is a hard thing. You get a particular, a sense of that there. And also you ask 100 sonnets of me, you get that kind of switch at the ends of those particular sonnets that from her sort of 1950s period. Yeah, so those are there. It's just the way in which she uses the rhyme scheme is particularly interesting. I think for people who are deeply invested in poetry who are listening to this, I'm sure there are a lot of people who are doing that, I think to look at her sonnets and then think about them in terms of how the sonnet form is working, historically, sort of classically, if you like, you'll find a lot of kind of particular, a lot of interesting things. Murdoch isn't just kind of repeating the same kinds of forms that she's seen. She's trying to be a little bit experimental with what she's doing, but still keeping within a kind of the kind of the structure that we would generally associate with the sonnet form, for example.
What do you think poetry offered her that she couldn't, as a means of expression, that she couldn't find in novels?
Yes, so obviously very best known as a writer of 26 novels, also a writer of philosophy, of course, from her earliest years, of course, trained philosopher and taught that at Oxford. Also a playwright. I don't think she gets an awful lot of recognition as a playwright of seven plays, some of which adapted from her novels, but others sort of standalone works. So she does try, and the play's mostly not particularly successful commercially, but certainly I think they are interesting, have an interesting literary value. I think the poems do something very different as well. She published very few of them during her lifetime, so maybe 35, 40 during her lifetime, and we've discovered about 550. So you can see that kind of the difference in the kinds of the ones that she tended to keep private. I think they allowed her to experiment in a certain way, but also to think about kind of, they were not exactly a private notebook, and they sort of the emotionals, the heightened emotions, but partly they do deal with that as well. I think there are some poems that are dedicated to particular individuals that are, you know, that she just couldn't publish because they were at that point in time, they were deeply kind of erotically charged and personal to her.
Yes, I was going to ask about that, if you felt that her poetry was somewhere where she felt safe to explore her bisexuality, which was presumably kind of tricky at that time and still
at that
sometimes
time
today.
For sure. Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, consenting homosexuality between males wasn't legalised until well into the 1960s, let's not forget. So, yeah, there was that sense, I think, that Murdoch, as a bisexual woman, wanted to explore these particular range of emotions within the fiction. Of course, she does that very successfully, and not just same-sex relationships, but all sorts of different relationships right the way through her fiction. And quite often it's kind of what we might think of as a traditional marriage the one that breaks down. I think famously of a novel, A Fairly Honourable Defeat, where the one relationship that lasts and works is the consensual homosexual relationship between two men. One thing I guess in the poetry is that she can be very clear about who she's writing to. So in the fiction, obviously, they are completely, you know, fictionalized characters, even though they share certain aspects and elements of people that she knew in her real life. She doesn't ever kind of take a real life person and just, you know, transfigure them into somebody fictional. That's not her way of working. But in the poetry, she does. So there are poems to her lover, Bridget Brophy, poems to her husband, poems to Wallace Robson, who was a fiancé of hers, a poem to Elizabeth Anscombe, who is one of her fellow philosophers, and, you know, a wonderful philosopher in her own right, of course. And you get, and more besides, you get this sense in the poetry that she can really let loose in, obviously, she's not an epic poet by any means, but in a very tight crystalline form that she can deal with these particular emotions and bring out as well, I suppose, that kind of more biographical element. Yeah, so there are obviously there are poems to men and poems to women, and both sides particularly erotically charged. And we know of some of these, obviously, from the biography, you know, about Elias Canetti, the Nobel Prize winning author. But I think perhaps less about really how she kind of related to her husband and also to other women. So I think those are important. And, you know, when we were making the selection for this collection, we were minded that we ought to kind of show Murdoch in, you know, in different facets of her personality, different relationships, to think about those kinds of aspects. And of course, you know, when the pre-publicity and the Times and Telegraph and the Guardian, that was a lot of what they picked up on was the sexuality aspect, which is fair, I think. And yet there's much more to these poems than just that.
Some of them, the Byronic one is very playful.
Yes.
Which I really like that side of it, that she was having fun with it. It's not a sort of question of the identity always kind of, you know, being a gloomy thing. It's playful. And
Sure. They are. Those two poems, yeah, the poems to Bridget Brophy. There's two poems in the collection to Bridget Brophy. And theirs was a difficult relationship at times, but they were also quite arch and very, they were both highly educated, brilliant writers, and both deeply invested in their relationship and in each other's writing as well. And I think that comes across on the page in those two short poems, particularly, as you say, the comedic one that Murdoch writes about to Brophy. But also there's a very serious point in there as well, I think, that Bridget Brophy wanted far more than Murdoch was willing to give, probably both physically and also, I guess, in terms of actual time spent together, even though they did spend a great deal of time together. So there is a kind of an archness, a playfulness, but also I think there's a serious kind of sense of setting boundaries as well to where the relationship could go. But the relationship did last for almost 10 years. So, you know, a very important one to both of them, I think.
When I was reading, I was very struck by the Yeats-like poems. And then I read the introduction and realised something I'd never realised before, which was Iris Murdoch was Irish by descent.
Indeed.
Do you think that was an important part of her identity as a poet and writer?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, important as a part of a poet, but also incredibly important to her sense of identity, sense of her selfhood, sense of her nationality. She always said she was Anglo-Irish. She never said she was British. I mean, there is a great poem in the obviously, yeah, great to mention Yeats, but also one of the later poems, Music in Ireland, dealing with the troubles, you know, the great tragedies that occurred in the 70s. And I think there's this sense, of course, of Murdoch's later on in her life being a little bit sort of not exactly anti-Irish, although perhaps in private it seemed that way. But she was deeply worried that Ireland was sliding into civil war. The Northern Ireland, and there's a deep worry about that, and that comes through in her poetry. But she never forgets the sense that, obviously, born in Dublin, even though she lived all of her life in England, she did go back to Ireland quite regularly, certainly as a child for holidays, and that never leaves her. The early reading, as you say, of Yeats, but also of Joyce and of Beckett. Beckett's such an important influence on her work, particularly early on. In the 1950s. And yeah, she never leaves Yeats behind. I think perhaps she leaves Joyce a little bit behind, but Yeats, I mean, the great poet, she never really leaves him alone, I don't think. She's always reading Yeates. And yeah, she was deeply proud of her Irish heritage and deeply proud to be offered honorary degrees in Ireland as well. So yeah, and certainly when her centenary came around in 2019, she got the Irish Post gave her a stamp, gave her a plaque on her house in Blessington Street in Dublin. They made a bit of a thing of Iris, which was lovely to see. And, her only short story is set in near Dublin. One of her novel, The Red and the Green, is set there during the Easter Rising. Her novel, The Unicorn, is set on the West Coast. So, yeah, great love and affinity with Ireland and Irish culture.
I was looking for traces of her philosophy work in the poetry. Like the personification of love and grappling with the tangibility of the world, I think, in a bit of a Heideggerian way, limitless language.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, sure. I mean, first thing to say, I guess you don't need to be a philosopher or be interested in philosophy to enjoy the poems. They're not deeply and obviously philosophical in the sense that they're kind of front and center of the poems. I don't think she's a philosophical poet in that way. They are, as you say, they're exploring love and the limits of language and ideas of pictures and ideas of symbolic images. And I think if you're a reader of her philosophy and you know, for example, you know, one of the great images from the Sovereignty of Good collection, the image of the hovering kestrel outside the train window, then you'll probably see that motif repeated. So in an early poem, Reverie in Winchester Cathedral, we have the same kind of image come through. So we have this swift and sudden sped a swallow from the vaulted dark and passed above my head. We get this sense of Murdoch, the young woman in Winchester Cathedral, and seeing this bird within the cathedral representing the Holy Ghost for her, connected to the spiritual. And I think that's an important aspect of her work. You also, I think, get this sense of the limit, as you pointed out, the limits of language. And you mentioned Heidegger, and I think she's more sort of drawn towards this kind of Wittgensteinian sense of the limits of language and what we can and can't say and the kind of boundaries of the self as well. But I think there is this sense of the spiritual that takes Murdoch over and above that limit. And quite often she's writing in that mode, particularly when she's thinking about nature. Also, I suppose another sort of important aspect of the philosophical dimension is that people listening know a little bit about Murdoch's philosophy, you'll know how important the notion of attention was, that, you know, to give the full attention to the other person, stripped of one's ego, and to see the person as they really are. I think that's an important aspect of the love poetry, but also, I think, of the individual's interactions with nature. So in the poem The Brown Horse, for example, or in Macaw in the Snow, in particular, the last poem in the collection, this deep connection with animal life and also with, you know, nature more generally, the natural landscape, really comes through. And I think that's the spiritual dimension of Murdoch that's maybe over and above the kind of the philosophical, beyond the philosophical limit, I suppose. So if you're looking for, I guess, imageries and pictures that Murdoch kind of uses in the philosophy and particular ideas about love, then you'll find them here. if you're looking for kind of a deeply philosophical poem, I guess the one to pick out would be Word Watcher, which is a poem for John Bailey. I think that's a deeply philosophical poem. Probably the only one that's kind of that's the one that springs to mind and is the, I guess, the most heightened philosophically in the collection. And it does reference Plato and Kant, and you can take a lot out of that, I think. Questions about wordplay and also about wordplay and love. But in general, I would say that this collection isn't overly concerned with the philosophical, but it's there, I suppose. If you want to find it, you can make some connections to it. That's for sure.
In your essay, you reference the sea, and Charles Harrop's anxiety about publishing his poem.
Yes, his cousin James.
And I would guess that reflects her own anxiety. And why do you think she felt so anxious about the quality of her poetry?
It wasn't just about the quality of her poetry; it's about the quality of anything she wrote. I think in one sense she was most confident about her philosophy, really. And because quite often when she talked, in interviews and also in letters to her huge range of correspondence, she'd spend 2-3, maybe sometimes in 4 hours a day writing handwritten letters. Everybody that wrote to Murdoch got a letter back, whether you were just a fan saying, "Oh, I really loved to see the sea," or whether you were one of her long-term friends, you always got a handwritten letter. There's a sense in the philosophy that she's explaining, she's being very clear and concise in what she wants to say. And she was trained in that mode. She was trained in the analytic method. And I think she was quite, certainly in the early to mid period of her life, not with Metaphysics of the Guide to Morals, but certainly with the early period, she was very confident, I think, as a philosopher. With the novels, it seems to me, certainly reading her private journals, which aren't published yet, but also the letters that are published, that she had great bouts of depression right the way through her life. And she was never that satisfied really with her fiction. Particularly as she got older, she was never very satisfied with the early stuff. She only really picked out The Bell, her fourth novel from 1958, as the kind of a novel that she'd like to remember. Some of the others she kind of passed over, including The Red and the Green from 1965, the novels that she wished she'd never published. So she was always anxious, I think, about her creative work rather than the philosophical work. And with the poetry particularly, I think because it was a private space in the main, although she published a number of poems during her lifetime, not that many, that she could use it to explore particular feelings and ideas. And also she was really worried about form and making sure that she didn't just ape other people, but created her own work. And so right the way through the notebooks, you'll see that there isn't just one version of any particular poem. Quite often there's 2, 3, 4. And for some poems, there's in the teens or even into the 20s of different versions of the same poem. And sometimes not within the same month or two, but sometimes spread out across years of her just trying to get that form right. And trying to, write. And in a sense, I think some of them are kind of, some of them not exactly abandoned, but you can see the kind of the process of this process of this great writer working through. There's a great line in The Black Prince that's every book is the wreck of a perfect idea. And I think that's how Murdoch felt about poetry, actually.
Oh, my goodness. That's a wonderful phrase, isn't it?
Yes. One of the classic Murdoch phrases. But yeah, I think, and coming back on that idea about her publishing, and what's Charles going to do with James's poems at the end of the sea, it's something that the four editors felt, we felt very, weighing very heavily on us, the ethics of publication, what to choose, what to leave out, how to, this, why it's taken quite a long time to come to, to be made public, I suppose.
What insights into Murdoch's world did you get from working on the collection?
Ooh. I suppose you've got an insight more into the biographical is the easy one to talk about, I suppose, because a lot of the poems are dedicated to people, and we were able to publish the poems with the dedications to these lovers and friends and other people, because invariably they're no longer with us, right? They're dead. So there isn't that kind of ethical worry anymore that you're going to be exposing a relationship. I suppose the Peter Conradi's biography in 2001, and then the letters in 2015, and so much else besides has been written in the last 20 years, that I don't think there's anybody who's particularly surprised about Murdoch's bisexuality or polyamory or however we're going to frame it. So we learned that. So yeah, questions around desire, questions around nature. I suppose as somebody that's been working on Murdoch for over 20 years, I didn't find anything completely brand new there, because, I'm reading Murdoch all the time and working in the archives, and you find particular facets of her work. But interesting at different points, of course. But because we've got the novels and the plays, and we've got the letters, and I've, you know, had the great good fortune to be able to look at the journals, but now we've got the poems. I mean, you can put all these together and form, I think, a very different picture of the Murdoch that we had maybe 20 or 25 years ago. So it's probably high time for a new biography now. And because of all this new information that's come to light, I think we can see her kind of, in a sense, struggling as an artist more now, I would say, struggling to kind of get to grips with what poetry actually is, and especially writing it, you know, from a teenager right the way through to her last years when Alzheimer's robbed her of her ability to write and think. Yeah, there are different aspects that we can see of Murdoch's life, particularly as somebody who, up until now, of course, we thought that poetry was something that she did in her early years, and then she didn't really bother with beyond about 1950, say, 1955. But it's just not the case. We've now got, you know, another 30, 35 years of poems. And as I say, no, this is just 88 out of 550 odd. So we've got lots, there's lots more in the archives that we haven't brought to light. And I think there is an awful lot more to be said and written on Murdoch. You know, there's at least, well, several more PhD theses, I'm sure, to be written, and more articles to be written about her life, because now the poems are thankfully available.
So that was what I was going to ask, how much more there is to be uncovered. So you say there's, was it 50? You've used about 50 poems.
There's 550 individual poems in the archives at the University of Kingston. And in this collection, there's 88. So just about 470 poems that are not out there, not published. So if people want to read them, they are open access at the University of Kingston, but they're not digitized and not available. So you'd have to go in physically and read them. But her journals covering the entirety of her life are at the University of Kingston. And they, although Peter Conradi drew on them for his biography, those have not been published either. So those need to be edited and maybe published at some point. Thousands of letters. So in 2015, Murdoch's selected letters were published. But that only accounted for several hundred. There are thousands of letters. Some obviously very workaday, but some are much more interesting in the collection. So yeah, there's for those people who are interested, you can visit the archives at the University of Kingston in South London from Monday to Thursday each week. Yeah, so people can go and look at these if you like. But there will be more publications at some point as we kind of. I see part of my work as the director of the centre at the University of Chichester, which is where research gets undertaken, as kind of helping to curate and kind of sustain Murdoch's literary heritage and kind of, you know, promote her. So myself and my colleagues and my PhD students and many, many people, loads of people around the world are doing this as well. So it's a burgeoning community of Murdoch scholarship.
It's very exciting that you've got so much more material still to uncover and create its collections. And I suppose, was there ever an ethical question, you know, that some of these were private, perhaps she wasn't that confident about them? Should they be left out
as
well?
Yes, absolutely. You're quite right. And so we discovered these in 2016, and now it's 2025, towards the end, you know, right at the end of 2025. So it's basically 9 years. We took a long time into the main process, really, was the transcription. Murdoch's early writing is very legible. As you get into the 70s and into the 80s, it's so difficult to read. And so to transcribe all these 550 poems and all their variants, and then to try and work out exactly what, you know, to think about them in terms of their quality and their poetic, you know, their poetic quality, but also in terms of how you'd viewed them in terms of the rest of her published work. I mean, that took quite a long time. But yeah, when it came to publishing them, one thing that struck us was that when she moved from the village of Steeple Aston, which is in Oxfordshire, back to Oxford, this was in 1985, she writes in her journal that she had an enormous bonfire in the back garden and burnt loads of stuff. Now, to somebody like me, that's a terrible thing, because you think, oh God, what was lost? Right. But it also suggests that Murdoch really wanted to keep these poems and really wanted them to remain, you know, have a physical presence and not be to be consumed by fire. So that was one thing, and that she'd left them there in the house. So we did have to make some ethical decisions around them, you know, also whether to include the names with some of the poems, particularly on the love poems and the sonnets, And we decided to because these people had already been named in biographies, so there wasn't any great surprise, I don't think. And also for the selection of poems that we published from Conversations with a Prince from 1963, those would have been typed up and made into fair copy and given to her publisher. But then Murdoch decided ultimately not to publish them and asked for them back about, but maybe sort of 10, 15, 20 years later, after sending them off to her publishers at Chateau and Windus. So we had those as well that she decided not to. But mainly, I think the main thing was, well, Murdoch didn't think that highly of her poetry. Should we do that? And ultimately, and should we publish? And ultimately, we thought we should, not just because we thought they were really good poems, the selection that we've chosen, but also because of the growing interest in Murdoch as a writer, and kind of the sense that, you know, we, you know, looking at these poems now rather than in the 60s or 70s, we can see that they're of both really good quality and also speak to our own time. I think, particularly as you say, poems around the relationship. So it was important for us to be sensitive to these ethical questions, but also ultimately we thought actually it's the right time to publish them in this environment.
Oh, I very much agree. Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Leeson, for coming on the show. And we're going to listen now to some recordings, which Dr. Leeson has made for us. And I think you'll enjoy them very much. Poems in the Attic is published by Penguin and it's out now. Thank you so much for coming onto the podcast.
Most welcome. It's been a pleasure. I find that honesty is a hard thing. For Wallace Robson. I find that honesty is a hard thing, but dappled deception is natural and sweet, simple, seductive, and most discreet in the weary grace of its surrendering. When the sun shines, the little birds sing, and pointed flowers prick my feet, and I become frisky and fleet and fly all tedious remembering. But I hope that nevertheless I may be most strongly chained and penned so that although I run with wildness, the tugged at tether will cast me to the ground. Until I have learnt mildness, being truth's prisoner in the end. Reverie in Winchester Cathedral. Chill grey and gracious arches rise and flow, and surging stones soar to a dim, rich roof with interlocking wings. And then, vibrating low, the organ moans, foaming in sweet crescendos, and its tones of shadowed splendour clothe the lily-pale virginity of breathless nave and aisle. I stood in awe and wonder for a while, in dread of such a silence and such sound, till swift and sudden sped a swallow from the vaulted dark and passed above my head. It seemed a spirit, like the Holy Ghost that beat its dove wings in far Galilee. I knelt in peace. Though yet the organ rings above it still, the darkening arches fill with a merciful murmuring of wings. Macaw in the Snow. Snow falls on Gloucester Road, and black processions of umbrellas bob, and penny large the flakes rotate, you in your cosy cage. Behind the window pane hang upside down, the pet shop star, then amble to my tap and tumble, eyeing me and turn a somersault. You are a clown. Then spread along, amazing as your wing. The snowflakes weave their wool between me and my fool, while I, all spotted white, perceive you warm and dry. Scan me with a saucy eye. Cool scaly claw and sickle iron beak. Bead of black tongue and witty eyes that speak a gentle badinage. While awkwardly the long tail feathers sweep about the gritty cage. No room to fly. I walk and leave you and I sigh with sorrowful amaze that our two spirits can identify simply by quiet gaze. I walk away and leave you and I sigh tears for your captive state. Once in some netted green, great wings astretch and conscious guiding tail, in sunleaf heat and river steam, gaily you assail. In your dim cage do you recall your Amazon and think it dream, as goodness which we scarcely sense yet seems a place where we lived once and we beguile our prison doom, we clap our wings and play the clown.
Dear Bright Macaw, in exile, oh, please pardon us the cage, the snow.